Welcome to Champagne Sharks, episode 14, Shame versus Guilt. Hey, how's everyone doing? This is T. On Twitter, I'm at Ricky Rawls, R-I-C-K-Y-R-A-W-L-S, no underscore. And just to get some house cleaning out of the way, I just want to remind everyone that if you're not subscribed to the Patreon for $5 a month, you are only getting half the content. If you go to patreon.com/champagnesharks, that's one word. So it's Patreon, patreon.com/champagnesharks, one word, no underscore or hyphen. If you go there, you can subscribe for $5 a month and get 8 episodes a month instead of 4, which I think is a steal. But what do I know? Another thing, I keep forgetting to do this on air, but I wanted to shout out to the website, Vicoli, C-O-L-I, Vicoli. A lot of people from that site have been showing the show support, and, you know, I enjoy that, especially because it's a site frequented by mostly black men, so it's good to see black men getting into the show. Not saying that I don't appreciate any other type of fan, but I do think it's very good to, you know, get a certain amount of approval from your own people. But this is what I wanted to talk about today. National Review had a race science article, and it's, you know, it's nothing new. It's the same old... race science people, you know, I say science in quotation marks because there's nothing scientific really about them. But race science people are interesting in that they just, for some reason, can't help from pathologically being intellectually dishonest. And it's a very interesting thing because it's really like a compulsion, the way they lie. And it's not really anything new, because white supremacists are pathological liars. And it's invariable. I mean, it's one of the things you have to get used to if you argue or debate with them. It took me a while to get used to the fact that they are very bold, pathological liars. Because people know about the phenomenon called projection, where you take something that applies to you and tend to see it in other people, or assume that other people think or believe the same things you do for the same reasons you do. And people usually think of projection with negative traits, like, oh, I have homosexual urges, so I'm going to project that into you and say that you're the one with homosexual urges. Or I am racist, so I don't want to admit that about myself, so I'm going to put that racism in you. Or I have self-hatred, but I don't want to admit that to myself, so I'm going to see you as the one with self-hatred, you know, you just put what you feel into someone else somehow. And people don't realize, though, that it also works with positive traits. So a lot of times people think, hey, because I wouldn't just blatantly tell a bald-faced, bold lie out of thin air, or because I wouldn't be incredibly intellectually dishonest, we tend to assume that a lot about other people as well that we're talking to. So a lot of times you see these people who are into race science and they have reputable jobs at reputable places, or if not reputable, at least legitimized places. And you think, okay, somebody who is educated at a good school, who works for what is ostensibly a journalistic publication, or, you know, someone who's in the sciences and has to be peer-reviewed, all these things, you just assume that they have a certain level of ethics about bald-faced lying. And one thing you have to get used to is white supremacist or suspected white supremacist shamelessly lie and just hope that you won't double check or think too hard about what they're saying. And they're very shameless about it. It's they do two things. They lie and they also bullshit, which is slightly different than lying. Because lying, you have to know the truth and consciously say the opposite. Whereas a bullshitter doesn't even care if what he's saying is true or no. The bullshitter just wants to convince you of something. And whether it's true or not is not even their concern. But those are the two things that white supremacists do a lot. And race scientists are very big into this. Now, it's called A Reply to John McWhorter. And the authors, the names are, one of them had a weird name, something like John Anomaly or something. And the other one's called Boutwell, Boutwell. I don't have their names handy. Oh, yeah, here it is. Jonathan Anomaly from University of Arizona and Brian Boutwell from St. Louis University. Now, one is a lecturer in philosophy, politics, economics, and law at University of Arizona. Boutwell is an associate professor of epidemiology at St. Louis University. Now, the fact that they're not scientists, I don't really hold that against them, because whether you're a scientist or not, if you're smart enough and you read the science and the history of anything, I don't want to see you disqualified from talking outside of your expertise. Because first of all, that'd make me a hypocrite, because the stuff that I talk about, I have not been formally trained in it at all. So, in a lot of ways, I'm an autodidact, meaning I self-teach myself a lot, many things. So, in that case, I'm not comfortable saying, oh, these guys are not actual geneticists. They don't have a right to speak. You can not be trained in something, but teach yourself and do enough of the hard work, especially if you're intellectually honest and intellectually rigorous. And you can say anything you want and make any contribution. And, you know, I'm not going to judge them based on not being scientists. But the problem is just a constant dishonesty. And I'll tell you what I mean. There are many books about race science, many studies about race science. And one of the things is, there are plenty of people who argue on both sides using science. Now, everything that the Charles Murrays of the world have written in books like Bell Curve, people like Arthur Jensen, John Derbyshire, Steve Saylor, all these people, one thing they love to say is that nobody responds to them. That they're just dropping these incredible truth bombs that are just so unimpeachable, so airtight. The science is so incredible, proving that black people have low IQs and have low IQs due to genetics, that it's something that is unfixable. They act like they have made this case in such an airtight way that their enemies are just a bunch of free speech censoring PC pearl clutchers who just can't even take the truth. They can't handle the evidence. So they're actively working to suppress it. And this article keeps that tradition alive, that dishonest tradition. I mean, there's so many people who have written scientific-based responses to the bell curve and other similar things. There's people like, there's scientists like Lewontin, Gould, Jared Diamond, and there's a book called The Dependent Gene by David Moore that summarizes all the arguments against genetic determinism. Genetic determinism being the idea that your genetics determine who you are to such a degree that there's little you can do to change what your genes dictate that you are. So genetic determinists who believe in race science, for example, their genetic determinism takes the form that for black people, their genetics determine that they're definitely going to be low IQ or unintelligent. Now, the dependent gene lays out so much of the science that has been developed to debunk much of what is considered genetic determinism. And it highlights the history and evolution of the findings that go against genetic determinism, right? In the book Monkey Love by Robert Sapolsky, who's a scientist, he also dedicates a chapter to summarizing much of the research against genetic determinism and the idea that genes can determine everything about a person to a very large degree. And also, Matt Ridley wrote about a lot of the research that goes against genetic determinism. And this article, what makes this article typical of a lot of the dishonesty of many race science advocates is it denies that anyone has ever actually addressed these issues and makes it seem like everyone is just running scared. And it's a weird thing that they do, but I kind of get why. It's weird because it's so blatantly untrue, as in anybody who takes 10 seconds can just find a bunch of papers on Google Scholar addressing race scientists with their own science all the time, you know? So when I say it's weird, I mean it's weird that they would just try such a blatant lie. But when you get used to them, it doesn't get so weird anymore. It's just how they are. But the reason why they do this, I get one reason why they do it. And that's because, like I said in earlier episodes, particularly the first one, white people fetishize the idea of science and logic. They're not always actually scientific and logical. They can be as hyper-emotional or irrational as anyone else. But they fetishize the idea that they're always following logic, that they're hyper-rational, that they're quote-unquote scientific. So it's easy to sell them a lot of stuff by either telling them that it's science, or you can turn them against other people by portraying other people as anti-science. You know, like, being labeled anti-science is probably nowadays what being labeled as a town atheist was in the times of Copernicus or something, you know, or in the times of Galileo. Like, it's something, it's like a form of social death almost. So they like to paint this picture of the only people opposing them being people who are anti-science, people who are against research, who like, you know, they're like, oh, we're just asking questions, you know, what's the big deal? And then they paint the other side as being these pearl clutchers that are just like, oh no, don't say it, it's just too harsh, you know. It's so stupid. Like, I just can't believe they can get away with printing the same article over and over again. And then you have to keep going back and saying, or at least I do, it's like, what about X scientists, Y scientists, Z scientists, these studies? There's a guy called Jay Joseph, and he also has a bunch of books talking about not only why genetic determinism has so many holes in it, but also he describes why twin studies, which are the main basis of where a lot of this stuff comes from, where they study twins who were raised together and twins who were raised apart and try to figure out what came about due to genetic influence, all the faults in those studies. He has a whole book even just about how the very study, type of study that they use as the cornerstone, the basis of all this stuff in general, is hopelessly flawed and unreliable. And just to give you one example that this book on twin studies discusses, right? Let's say you have a pair of twins and they're raised apart. What a twin study will come up with is, okay, hey, look, this girl is in one school, her twin sister is in a school 3,000 miles away. Both of them turn out to be homecoming queens, date the star athlete at their school. They both ended up becoming models. They both ended up having similar grades. They both ended up having all these similarities in their lives. And it must be because all these things are connected to genes, being that they're not raised the same way. Meanwhile, the other children in their households are more different from these girls than they are from each other. So these girls live 3,000 miles apart and are very, very similar. Meanwhile, their adopted siblings or whatever that they share an environment with, they're very different from. So the fact that they're more similar to each other, even though they're 3,000 miles away, than they are to the people that they live with, must mean that genes, not environment, is to blame or to credit for all of their traits. That's a typical twin study finding. Now, the problem is that it doesn't have to be genes, at least not in the way that people think. For example, if I'm a good-looking woman, say like I'm a 9, I have more in common with other 9s across America and across the world, whether or not I'm related to them, whether or not I share the same genes, just because we're all 9s, and people just treat 9s a certain way. I mean, basically, it's not uncommon for someone who is incredibly attractive to be popular, to be confident, to date the best-looking person in school, the most popular guy, to get a certain amount of positive feedback that affects their development. The similarity between those two twins can simply just be because they're hot and they get treated a certain way based on their hotness, no matter how they're related. You see what I'm saying? This is something that makes the twin studies very unreliable. Because take, for example, picture like you're a nerd and you're ugly, whatever. Nerds can meet each other. Unattractive nerds can meet each other. People who have had no type of relation to each other, who have never met each other. Two adult nerds can meet each other and reminisce over high school and have, more often than not, a frighteningly similar experience. Bullying, social rejection, trouble getting dates, social anxiety, bitterness. Yeah, you can go on a 4chan message board and just see a bunch of nerds who are unattractive a lot of the times commiserating about stuff in a hateful way. And those guys aren't related to each other. They're just have similarities in how they look and how they appear and how they were raised that caused them to have similar experiences. It has nothing to do with genes. So with twins, the fact that the identical twins are always going to look the same, it's going to tend to lead to them being treated the same no matter where they are, which in turn leads to them developing the same. So these articles, these findings have been used to attack the very core of the studies, the type of studies that race science relies on the most. And being that there's whole books compiling these studies, debunking the validity of twin studies, makes you again wonder, what is this article talking about this impression of these anti-science censorship crowd who are just so afraid to talk about race science. It's something that should be discussed when discussing these articles way before you even start getting into the content of whether or not race science is true. It's more important in my book to question the motives of people who are pathologically disingenuous and pathologically intellectually dishonest like this. You have to really wonder why. That's the more important question. That's the more important concern that articles like this raise in me. Most people just want to jump in and start arguing about the so-called science. Like, they want to jump in and say, oh my God, that's not true. Black people aren't genetically stupid. Here's why, you know, and bring up all this stuff. And I'm like, no, don't go there, because there's plenty of people who have made all these arguments already, grounded in science, grounded in logic, against race science. People have made these arguments already. What's important to me, more important, is to ask, why are you lying? And what are you getting out of it? And why should I give you a good faith debate if you're revealing yourself to either be too sloppy and lazy to pull up what the opposition is really saying, or too dishonest and shady to say it? It's got to be one or the other. You're either ignorant and sloppy, or dishonest and therefore untrustworthy. So I would say, why even respond to that? This is someone who's hasn't earned the right of a response, because they've just shown themselves to be unreliable for whatever reason. The other thing that I think people have to think about is, even if what you're saying is 100% true, let's say you're absolutely right that you have this airtight science showing that black people are genetically doomed to stupidity and that no outside interventions are going to make much of a difference. Their genes just make them unable to have their IQ raised as a group. What are you going to do about it? And these articles never say what they plan to do. Like, are you going to propose eugenics, voluntary sterilization? Like, what is your plan? Do you want black people to just stop striving and accept a lower place in society? Should we affect college admissions? Like, what are your policy ideas? And they never really like to say. For example, one time I was even perusing a race science site, and these people, there were tons of commenters, like hundreds of commenters, tons of articles, you know, just trying to compile the case for race science. It was like a blog, and they were all into it. And then one time I asked, I'm like, you guys have been doing this for years. I went into the comments and I said, what policy are you guys going for? Are you lobbying politicians? Are you making policy? What are you advocating? And no one could answer me. And I was like, there's no way you can fixate on this for hours and hours a day to the point where you make it a cause. Like this is your waking, living cause, proving black people are genetically stupid, trying to raise awareness of it, and you have no actual policy you want to come out of it? I mean, that's very strange. So either the people involved in this don't really have any type of greater good that they're aiming for, that they just want to be able to say all day that black people are stupid because it shores up their self-esteem. You know, I'm thinking that's probably one issue, that they're doing this and obsessing over it all day just as a way to shore up their own ego, to say, hey, you know what? No matter how bad my life is, at least I'm not one of those black people who's so genetically defective that they're doomed to stupidity, you know, for the rest of their life. Or the other thing I think is, I think they do have policies, and it could be a mix of the two. Some people could fall into the first category, some people fall into the second. But the second category, I think, is people who do have things they want to say, but they don't want to be the one to say them, because they know if they say it, it'll be fatal to their so-called movement. So they just figure, if we get enough people on board with this idea, even if we have to do it by lying, which is like, you know, one of the things that happens in this National Review article, where they just pretend that there's this conspiracy to silence science by unscientific PC liberals and people who just are afraid of hurting black people's feelings with the truth, right? You know, if they use that lie to sell enough people on, then hopefully one of those other people, or as a group, almost like a mass uprising, people will start to enact these hideous policies without them having to tell them to. You know what I mean? If you get enough people to believe in something, the policies will eventually come along organically. So I think they probably do want eugenics. They probably do want a total removal of social safety nets, total removal of any type of government intervention to help black people, you know, more benign neglect. But they just don't want to be the ones to say so prematurely. They want to get enough people on board so that it comes up later on its own. And this can be shown by someone called William Shockley. William Shockley, decades ago, was one of the big race science guys, and he used to debate Francis Cress Welsing and a whole bunch of other people, and the media paraded him around left and right all over the place to say his provocative ideas, and he was doing the same thing. He was like, oh, everyone's afraid of the science, and no one wants to tell the truth, and you know, even, and just the same thing, ignoring every good argument against him, no matter how evidence-based, or minimizing it. Like, what these guys basically do is they do the intellectual equivalent of putting your fingers in your ears and going, la, 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 I can't hear you, I can't hear you. Then when you finish talking, you know, they take their fingers out their ear and they're like, whoa, I guess no one had a good response to my devastating truth bombs. Like, that's how mature they are. But anyway, people were always debating William Shockley. And just by the process of always debating him, you were kind of legitimizing him, you know, and some people generally do respond with pearl clutching and saying you can't talk about X, Y, and Z. And those are the people that race science types will love to debate the most and highlight the most and talk about the most. But the ones who don't do that, they will ignore and minimize. Now, at the height of his notoriety, he did an article, an interview in Playboy. And in Playboy, someone finally asked him the question. It took long enough, but at Playboy, someone finally asked him the question, okay, what do you propose that we do if this is true? So instead of just asking him, hey, what do you believe and what do your opponents believe and why do you think they believe? Instead of asking all that, he said, okay, fine. What are you going to do? What do you want? And when they asked that, Shockley finally said what he wanted, like voluntary sterilizations and all types of ways to stop black people from procreating, a total abandonment of any help to black people, and all types of heinous stuff. And once he said that, his career was pretty much done as a public intellectual because he wasn't supposed to say that. And even a lot of other race scientists kind of took a little distance from him, not because they were horrified, but because now he was a little radioactive because he was not supposed to say that. It was too alienating to their cause. And they wanted to win people over to their cause. And they wanted to avoid discussing the real ugly truth of what they believed in because it kind of reveals them to be modern Nazis, which repulses a lot of people, even people who aren't particularly fond of black people. Just that imagery of Nazis and Nazism will turn off even a lot of anti-black people because, you know, they associate Nazis with killing other white people. So this article, I wish people, from now on, when you see an article like this, the two things I would ask first and foremost, I would ask, and this is what you should do, find the author on Twitter, or if you get a chance to engage, just say, what about all the scientists who respond to this stuff with science? Even if what you were saying is true, and there are a handful of people who are just pearl clutching and not wanting to discuss the topic, why does that matter when there's so many scientists, past and present and future, who are more than willing and who do make studies addressing all of the stuff race scientists say? I mean, every single prominent race science study or race science book has a ton of articles and books responding to it on the merits. So challenge them on that. Like, just ask them, are you ignorant or are you being dishonest? And if people are addressing all this stuff, why not change the narrative to just summarizing what your opponents really did say instead of just creating this fantasy oppression narrative? Because one thing a lot of reactionaries and right-wingers have for some reason is oppression envy or victim envy. It's weird. They somehow, when they see other people complaining about victimization or oppression, their first thought, instead of trying to create justice, and remove oppression, their first thought is, why do they have all the fun of being oppressed? I don't know why this is, but this is becoming more and more a prominent part of conservatism, especially white male conservatism. Yeah, and again, the second part I would bring up when talking to these people is, what do you propose we do about this if it's true? What are your policy suggestions? What would you bring to a politician that you were giving money to? Like, what are the policy things you would ask him to implement? You know, what do you want Congress to pass? What do you want the Supreme Court to pass? What do you want black people to do? Yeah, those two things. Why are you framing a narrative like this? Where do you want policy and society and culture to go from here, if it's true? Now, I want to tie into something else that I discussed last episode. Last episode, the premium one, you have to go to the premium one to get it. Episode, what number is it? I think 13. The one about the word nigger. I was talking about how the power from nigger comes from the fact that it doesn't mean anything. And by not meaning anything, you can't refute it. You know, like, if somebody calls you a monkey, you can just look at yourself and look at a monkey and make a case, if you were so inclined to, about all the reasons you're not a monkey. If somebody called you lazy, if somebody called you stupid, you can disprove that. You can be like, okay, that's not true that I'm lazy. I get up at 6 in the morning every day, go to the gym, show up to work before everyone else, I leave the latest and I get the most done. How am I a lazy person or stupid? I went to the Ivy League and I got an IQ test. I'm this smart and I have won all these debate awards. So yeah, you know, I can disprove that. Nigger, you can't disprove because it doesn't mean anything except that you're black and you're living in a society where black means the most inferior. That's what nigger is. The word nigger is just a reminder of those two things, that you're black and you're living in a society where being black is the worst thing you can be. Now, this is where the difference between shame and guilt comes in. Shame is the idea that you, as an entity, you as a fundamental part of what you are bad. Now, guilt means you did something bad. So to illustrate the difference, shame is I am stupid. Guilt is I did something stupid. I'm a regular person who just did something stupid. Or shame is I am bad. Guilt is I did something bad. You know, it's not necessarily that you yourself are fundamentally bad as a fundamental, you know, that badness is your fundamental attribute. You might normally be a very good person, but this action you did just happened to be a bad action. Now, the difference between the two is guilt is much more fixable, because if you did something wrong, then you can make a restitution and make it right. You can do the opposite. If in many cases, you can take actions that undo what you did. When the problem is that you are fundamentally bad, that's different. When you yourself are bad and not your actions, you can't really change. And that's where a lot of neurosis comes from shame. Because once your negative traits are unchangeable, you know, once the negativity is not what you're doing, but the negativity is actually you, the negativity is your essence, like your essence is defective, your options are either to, there's three things you can do to any type of mental disturbance coming from cognitive dissonance. There's three tactics. And it corresponds to nature. In nature, when you're faced against something life-threatening, you have what used to be called the fight or flight response, but now many scientists actually have added a third one called freeze. So it's fight, flight, or freeze response. Not just fight or flight, but fight, flight, freeze. You can either fight against it, you can run away, or you can just act like nothing's going on and freeze and hope that the problem just goes away by you not addressing it one way or the other. Psychologically, there are responses, neurotic responses to mental traumas that correspond to fight, flight, or freeze. And what they're called is overcompensation. When you overcompensate, that's like the fight in fight, flight, or freeze. The other thing you can do in response to a psychic threat is you can surrender to the threat. Like, you know, oh, if you say I'm stupid, I'm just going to give up and let myself be stupid and consider myself stupid. I'm going to internalize that. I'm just going to surrender to it, which is, you know, the next psychic response, surrender. Surrender corresponds to freeze, right? So overcompensation is fight. Surrender is freeze. And the last response to psychic trauma is avoidance. And avoidance corresponds to flight. So just like you have fight, flight, or freeze, you have overcompensation, avoidance, or surrender. Now, when you overcompensate against shame, like, you know, when you're being confronted with shame, like, you are defective, which is what nigger does. The word nigger is saying you're black. You're fundamentally defective. No matter what you do, you're always going to be black and the system of white supremacy. Now, your choice is either to overcompensate against that shame, and overcompensating against shame is narcissism. Surrendering or avoiding shame is codependence. Both the narcissist and the codependent both have shame issues. They both think they're fundamentally defective. And they both think that, you know, it's hard for them to change, that they can't change. But the difference is they've both taken different steps against it. The narcissist has decided, if I'm going to be defective, I'm not going to let myself feel that defectiveness. I'm going to overcompensate and make myself appear as superior as possible. I am not ever going to admit to myself my shame. I am going to fight against that inferiority feeling as much as possible, whether I have to make other people feel worse than me or have to artificially inflate myself by lying, by covering up, by showing off. Because remember, being that this is who you are and not what you do, the option of becoming truly superior doesn't really factor for a narcissist. A narcissist is more into appearing superior, whether or not that's actually the case. They're more into bullshitting and pretending because they really believe that they can't change themselves. And a codependent is someone who also has shame issues, believes that they can't change themselves, but has just kind of made a certain peace with that identity of inferiority, wears it on their sleeve, has full access to their low self-esteem. Now, collectively, white people traditionally, under a system of white supremacy, collectively operate as narcissists. They have their shame issues. They have their fears of inferiority, but their answer to that is to overcompensate. And that overcompensation is the narcissistic / sociopathic system of white supremacy. Whereas black people have been beaten to submission with shame to the point that they have become codependents to white people collectively. You know, as individuals, you have a lot of individual white people who, you know, are totally not narcissistic. Even racists, you have a lot of racists who, as individuals, may not be narcissistic or sociopathic. They have empathy for their tribe, for their friends, their family. But when they operate against black people, and especially when they're operating as part of the white collective, they, in those situations, will become very, very empathy lacking, narcissistic, sociopathic. And the same for black people. I have many black people who, as individuals, are not codependent, have a certain amount of confidence or self-esteem, but as when dealing with white people, especially as part of a collective, they show signs of codependency. Now, narcissists need codependence to feel shame, because if codependence were to feel guilt rather than shame, like if codependence were to believe their actions could change their lives and improve themselves, then they wouldn't be codependent anymore. They would work on their problems and feel in what they call an internal locus of control. The codependent would feel, you know what? I can improve myself. I'm not fundamentally defective. I don't have to stay inferior. The narcissist needs somebody who's permanently inferior so that they can be permanently superior. If your inferiority is not permanent, if your inferiority is fixable through attainable actions, you're useless as an acolyte to a narcissist. You're useless as a prop that they can use to prop up their own self-esteem. You know, now you're almost like a threat. So one thing that narcissists like to do is they like to devalue. They like to keep the shame active in you. And white supremacists as a group do that same thing with black people. White supremacists like to keep black people in the shame zone. And I say white supremacists as a collective. Like, you have a lot of individual good white people, but when they operate as part of the American collective, they in many ways contribute to that climate that keeps black people in that shame-filled, codependent state. Now, by the way, this is going to tie into the race science stuff. This is not just a divergence, but nigger is a shame insult. Like I said before, and at the end of the day, nigger is just about you're black and in the system of white supremacy. And no matter what you do, you can't change that. And if you look, a lot of times black people try to make nigger into a guilt insult. And what I mean by that is they try to make nigger mean something that has to do with action. So, for example, Chris Rock's infamous black people versus nigger skit, right? That sketch. He's doing what a lot of black people do, which is they try to redefine nigger to mean someone who's lazy, who's uncouth, who's rude, who's quote-unquote ghetto, who's criminally inclined, who just ruins black neighborhoods with their criminality and their backwards ways, their primitiveness. Like, you know, nigger means primitive. See, and by making it mean all those things, you as a black person can now transcend niggerdom by taking the corresponding opposing actions. I just won't act quote-unquote ghetto. I'll speak properly. I will behave this way. I will act this way. I will get a college degree. If nigger means these negative actions, then to transcend nigger them, all I have to do is do the corresponding opposite positive actions. And you'll notice there's a long history of black people trying to change the meaning of nigger to represent certain actions, which would make it a guilt sensation, which is way more empowering. And, you know, guilt, only to fix guilt, what you have to do is apologize if you did something wrong, acknowledge it, own it, and then take the necessary actions to make things right. You know, to fix shame, you have to change the very core of who you are, which in many cases is impossible, especially if, say, it's skin color. Like, what can you do? Your skin color, your lips, your nose, what can you do about that, right? There's nothing. So your only hopes are to try to hide, to lie, to cover up, to try to find someone who's even more fundamentally defective than you and keep them around. You know, so you could be the narcissist to their codependent, you know, try to find somebody that you can shit on. It leads to a lot of different pathologies that we associate with narcissism, sociopathy, codependency. Now, race science is the refined way of saying nigger. Race science is the refined, more respectable way for white supremacists to instill shame in black people. Because race science is a new way of getting across the same message that the word nigger gets across, which is, you are fundamentally defective. You have a shame problem. You have an identity problem. This is in your genes. Like, science is saying this. Science is saying that you are unchangeably bad. So the motivation that race scientists get from pushing race science is a new, legitimate, more airtight way of getting black people to accept their roles as permanently inferior. Because that's what white supremacy wants. That's what narcissists want. Narcissists want permanent appearance of superiority over people whose job it is to permanently be inferior. And that requires getting the permanently inferior people to internalize that sense of inferiority. That's a big thing with narcissists. They need codependence for all their superiority, for all their so-called superiority. They are very dependent on the people that they deem inferior. So, yeah, shame versus guilt. That's what the word nigger is about. That's what race science is about. Race science is just an elevated, more highbrow, more legitimate seeming, because even like white liberals fetishize science. They even put it under protest signs now. You know, they had the recent science march that liberals had. And I've seen posters that say, like, you know, I believe in Black Lives Matter, gay rights, and science. Like, liberals have put that on their signs now. So, all this is to say, don't just jump into arguments with people. Just really try to spend more time figuring out why they're arguing, what they're arguing, who the audience is. Are they being honest? Why are they saying this now, and why are they saying it to me? I want you to get into the habit of looking at things like this. Don't just jump into saying, hey, that's not true, and then just start countering with your own facts. Like, well, actually, black IQs are this. Like, don't do that, because it's not really about that. It's about legitimizing the idea of black people as permanently inferior. And just by getting you to constantly make the case against them, it gives the impression that it's a legitimate debate and that it's a stronger case than it really is. That's what they always like pretending, that they haven't been addressed, and sucking people into readdressing them over and over again. And one thing narcissists like to do also is they like to play with their food. And what I mean by that is, like, you ever see a cat that doesn't kill a mouse, but just tortures them and just kills them really slowly and just, you know, plays with them? Sometimes it lets the mouse get away a little bit, then slaps the paw back down, you know, gives the mouse like a little bit of hope, and then it shuts down the mouse's hope, and then it might eventually kill the mouse after a long period and then not even eat it. Like, they didn't even need it for food. They just wanted to just torture it and give it like little bouts of hope and give it a slow, terrorizing death. Narcissists are like that with their food, which is codependence. They like to give them a little bit of hope. Like, it's more fun to crush them if you give them a little bit of hope every now and then before you re-crush them. It's part of the toying of it. Like, sociopaths and serial killers used to do it too. A lot of them would like to torture their victims and, you know, give them a sliver of hope, like they might let them go before killing them. And that increases the sense of omnipotence, the sense of power, that, hey, I can control whether you feel hope, and I can take away that hope. I can give you privilege, I can take away privilege, I can give you self-esteem, I can take away self-esteem. I am your God. And that's what a lot of white supremacists like doing with black people. A lot of white people like giving black people hope that they're not inferior. And then it makes it more fun to just do like Lucy and, you know, Peanuts and Charlie Brown. It's maybe an old reference, but Lucy used to hold a football and make Charlie Brown try to kick it and give him hope that this time she wasn't going to pull the football away. And Charlie Brown would get hope that this time he was going to get to kick the football. He'd run up to it, and each time she'd pull away the football, he would kick and miss and fall on his ass. And that was part of the joy. Every time she would talk up to him that this time he's really going to get to kick the football. Now, going back to the word nigger, you look at Chris Rock, and white people really loved that black people versus niggers joke. And some people I met who were pretty, really racist, really liked that joke. And it makes you wonder, like, why do so many racist white people love this joke? And my theory, my personal take is, it's like playing with your food. It's like giving that hope before you dash it away. It's like Lucy in the football and Charlie Brown getting the hope that he's going to kick it this time. They enjoy seeing black people try to make nigger into a guilt word, to try to find out what actions, like, it's fun to watch them try to find out and deconstruct and decipher what actions create niggerdom, and try to figure out how to take counter actions to transcend niggerdom. Like it's fun for them to watch you do that, because they know it's utterly futile and it's not going to work. And it's like watching Charlie Brown run to the football. It's like lifting your paw off the mouse's tail for like 5 seconds and just watching them run and seeing that look in the mouse's eyes that he thinks, oh my God, I'm getting away. I'm free. This is happening. You know, right before you just have realities come crashing back down. That's why I think they like nigger. Like, wow, look at this nigger. He thinks he can behave his way out of being a nigger. This should be fun. Let's watch this. And, you know, they'll let you get as far as you can taking these anti-nigger actions, you know? Wow, look at him. He's dressing nice. He really thinks he's not a nigger now. What? Look, he's got a degree. Oh, my God. He even, like, talks like a human being now. Like, you know, he's not talking like ghetto. This is rich. Like, you know, he really thinks he's not a nigger. Like, let's encourage it. Like, yeah, you know, you're not a nigger. You're a black person. Those other ones are niggers, you know. Keep trying. What else are you going to do? And then, you know, they let you get as far as you can get in these counter-nigger actions, you know, these actions that are supposed to prove that you have transcended niggerdom and that you are a black person, or even better, you've transcended blackness altogether and you're an honorary white person. They're going to let you get to that point and then pull the football, or then pull the rug out from under you, or then slap the paw down on your tail, or whatever other metaphor you want to mix in, because I'm just vomiting metaphors right now. But it makes the torture more fun. And I think that's the infatuation behind that Chris Rock, joke. Why white racists like it so much. It's entertaining to them, you know, and it helps them with making you jump through hoops. Like, you know, they like letting you think that you can transcend niggerdom by taking actions, because they can get you to do things. It helps them weaponize their attention, you know, like, because they could be like, wow, Tyrone, you're doing really well, man. You're really articulate and stuff. And the message there is, wow, you're really, you know, you're really not a nigger. You're like one of those black people, or better yet, you're almost just like me. You're like an honorary white person. Like by giving you that hope, it helps them control you and make you jump through whatever hoops they want you to jump through. But it also makes it that much more fun when the fall comes, because now you're falling from a higher height. It's more enjoyable to tear you down from higher than it's more fun to tear you down when you're a mile above the ground than when you're only 3 inches above the ground. And that's another aspect that's also in this race science stuff. This race science stuff is very built toward kind of giving people hope that they can do something to argue against it, and then just keep going back to this. Well, you know what? Nobody's responding. This science still stands. Like, I think a lot of what happens with these race science people, where they ignore the people who have the contrary science, I think what they're doing is, we're going to let you make all these arguments, all these scientific counters. And after you do all that, we're just either going to minimize it or ignore it and just keep restating the same thing. So each time you get hope, because somebody responded, you know, with what should have been the definitive takedown or of the bell curve, like 10 scientists wrote in-depth things about all the flaws of the bell curve. People have written these books summarizing why twin studies don't even work and aren't reliable. They do all this stuff. After you do all that, you start getting hope that you've, you know, vanquished this beast once and for all. Someone just comes back with an article just pretending that no one said any of that stuff, you know, which is what this National Review thing is. Someone just comes back and says, well, okay, it looks like no one responded to us. So it looks like the undeniable truth is still niggers are stupid and genetics make it so. So, yeah, that's the last thing I want to say about that. So anyway, hope this was useful. Hope it was productive. And if it wasn't, I'm sure I'll hear about it. And just let me know what you think. And contact me at Twitter, at Ricky Rawls, like I said before. And again, if you're enjoying this show, sign up on the Patreon. Go to patreon.com/champagnesharks and going forth, make sure to be good to yourselves and be good to others. All right? Take care.